Michigan Healthcare will come to order, and I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 756. And we need Martin Taylor and Cindy Becker, please. It's my understanding you have news to report.
We do. Representative Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor with the Oregon Nurses Association. Typically, when a bill is no longer necessary to solve a problem, it just doesn't show up on a calendar. But the Representative Greenlick thought that it might be helpful for you guys to get the kind of good news that your legislative process doesn't always generate, which is a bill that caused the parties to get together and find a way to solve the problem without you. And I'm going to do that very briefly, but I want to start by saying that it is not unusual for this to happen. It just normally happens before session when you have a bill idea and the parties get together and discuss how to avoid legislation. And you rarely get to see that part of the process, and that's something that ONA has always made an effort to do before we introduce policy bills to you. In this case, it wasn't a bill we introduced. It was a bill that was introduced on behalf of a constituent of Senator Morissette's, and we took an interest in the bill and tried to move it through the process. So we adopted it a bit late. On very short notice, managed care providers who have been excluding nurse practitioners from contracts or provider panels in three parts of the state have gotten together in all three of those companies and agreed to figure out a way to make sure that nurse practitioners can be part of those provider panels short of a state mandate. And for them to have done that quickly as an alternative to legislation is a compliment to both their sincerity in trying to solve this problem and also to the ability for our organizations to work together. So that's the kind of good news you rarely hear, and the purpose of doing this is to let you know that you can solve problems that you don't even get to see sometimes. This was one of them.
Cindy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cindy Becker, and I'm the executive director of COHO. I find myself in the position of having a similar refrain, which is what I did earlier this week, which is what he said. Essentially, both parties, the plans, three plans that have not been working with nurse practitioners on a regular basis have agreed to get together with them. We're very happy to have those conversations and see what we can figure out that benefits everybody. So we're very pleased at this activity, and we're pleased that the two groups are going to get together.
Thank you both for coming. Is there anyone else that would like to be heard on this issue? Well, thank you so much for coming, and I'm confident that all of the other issues we tackle today will end with such harmonious outcomes.
Good luck.
Thank you. And I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 756. And now I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 591. And we have invited testimony from Tracy Homaker and Marjorie Carlson. And Sandy, would you give us a brief overview and remind us what we're doing here?
Thank you, Madam Madam Gelser, members of the committee. Senate Bill 591, you'll recall, we had a public hearing on the 17th of May. This allows the health care provider or state health plan to charge no more than $35 for copying 10 or few pages of a patient health record. It increases the maximum amount that may be charged for each additional page copied from 25 cents up to 50 cents a page. You'll recall we had quite a lively discussion, and we brought some folks who are here to answer any of your specific questions on concerns about the bill. Thank you.
So would you like to start with a brief statement before we open
up to
questions?
Sure, I can do that. Yeah, my name is Tracy Hammaker. I am from Bend, Oregon, and I'm here representing DBS Health Information. I spent a great deal of time with Representative Richardson this morning answering a lot of his questions. He asked specifically to see our profit and loss statement for our company so he could have proof that we have indeed incurred a loss since 2003 when the rates went into effect. Prior to 2003, the rates that we were using were similar to what Washington State has legislated since 1993, but we changed it a little bit to be less than what their fee schedule was. So we're trying to be fair and reasonable in the business that we do. We have no intention of price gouging. My family started our company 20 years ago in the event that my dad lost his position with Motorola, and he thought it would be good to start a company where he could work for himself and offer an opportunity for people of Oregon to work for an employer of that he would want to work for. So he set this company up, and he's been trying to do business in a way that would provide for his family and offer other Oregonians gainful employment. And that's what that's why we're in business, is to support our healthcare community and to support our families. So when we're asking for the fee increase, we're just asking that it be brought up to an industry standard. All of the states in the United States, I went online and looked at the list. I presented this to Representative Richardson. And out of all of the states, 31 of the states have rates that are higher, some of them far higher, and which I would consider price gouging in some of those that they have legislated. But 31 of the states are higher fees that they've legislated for copies of this health information. One of the points that I think is most important for us to remember is that retrieving the health information is not simply pushing a button to get a copy. It is far more complicated than that. I'd love to invite you all to come with me to Salem Hospital so I could take you on a tour to see how we go about reproducing that record. There are records that have been microfilmed that need to be part of a patient's record. There's still the paper record. Then there's an electronic medical record. The electronic medical record is often not just one software program. Oftentimes it's at least two, because they started with one program that didn't seem to do what they wanted it to do, so we've opened up another one. So oftentimes we have to access two. Then there's a scan document program that we have to access to get the medical records, because they're trying to back scan the medical records to get them in electronic form. So now we have three electronic medical records. And then on top of that, you put in the, in order to follow HIPAA law, the use and disclosure laws, we have to have a tracking software where we track what has been released specifically into who. So the process is so much more complicated and complex and time-consuming than what I heard in the last hearing, that don't you just take the record and make a copy? You just don't do that. It takes a lot of time. And in order to cover our costs, we're asking that you revisit these fees. It's been 4 years.
Thank you for that clarification. Did you want to make a statement before we open it up to questions?
Yes, I did, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. My name is Marjorie Carlson, and I'm Director of Health Information Services at Oregon Health and Sciences University. And I am here to testify on behalf of the Senate bill. We have outsourced our release of information function for several years with an Oregon company, which is Diversified Business Systems. For the last several years, we have had to, because they are limited in the amount of money that they can charge for copies of records, we have had to offset that cost by paying for supplies and postage. What concerns me the most here is that there has not been an increase in what they have been able to charge in the last 4 years, and their ability to be competitive in the workforce is a concern to me. They have 6 to 7 employees that work at OHSU, and they represent OHSU, and they provide customer service in that capacity. And if they are not able to be competitive in terms of the employees that they recruit, I feel that they may not be able to retain staff that have the skill and knowledge that we would look for in employees that we would hire to fill this position. So I feel that it's very important in terms of providing high-level service that they are able to remain competitive and recruit employees of the caliber that we would expect to represent OHSU.
Thank you so much for your testimony and for providing this information. Colleagues, do you have questions? Representative Greenwood.
Yes, I really do. And one would infer from your testimony that the bill somehow relates to what they can charge. And my reading of the statute is doesn't have anything to do with them, right? That's what you can charge for a request to you?
No. They are working on our behalf, and they can charge only what is limited by this legislation. We don't charge them anything. They provide the service to us, staff, the function.
Yes.
The legislation talks about what a hospital or a health system, what a health system or something can charge. It's what you can charge.
Yes.
You can only charge something to a patient. You can pay them whatever you decide you want to pay them based on on your outsourcing contract. Is that right?
That's correct.
So this doesn't, and this has no limit to what they can charge. They can charge you whatever they want to charge you, whatever you're willing to pay. You can only charge the patient the amount that's in the statute.
That's correct.
Can I address that? Mm-hmm. As our company is an Oregon-based company, we only do business in Oregon. We have one hospital that we work for in Washington. Our competition is national companies that have deep pockets. And if we were to go to OHSU or any of our other facilities and increase what and ask them to pay a higher fee than they're already paying for our services, they would go out for proposal to our competition. The competition would easily be able to underbid us because they have deep pockets, and what they want is a corner of the market. They want to monopolize the market in the United States to do what they do. And so they're willing to take a loss or break even in order to have Oregon's clients. So Marjorie would have no choice but to go out for proposal and get the best contract she could financially for her hospital, and our Oregon business wouldn't be able to stay in business.
Further question?
Yeah. So the problem is free enterprise here. Is that, is that what the problem is, competing in the real world? Is that the problem? I mean,
Representative, I'd like to just make a statement on what...
And I'm a Democrat. I'm opposed to free enterprise. All my colleagues tell me that all the time. But I'm just checking out.
You're getting the picture.
I can speak to an experience of one of our competitors. They did go out to bid, and they hired a California company, and that lasted for about 1 year, and now they're looking at bringing it in-house because that California company, based on the reimbursement in this state, could not make the profit that they felt was viable for them to succeed here. So I think we've had a very positive experience with the company that we've done business with for the last 10 years, and I would not want to see that changed. And if we were to bring this in-house, just doing the rough figures, it would be close to $500,000 in cost to the hospital to staff this function completely.
Are there further questions?
Thank you.
I have one. Last week during the testimony, the letter indicated that there had been a reimbursement in terms of the purchase of supplies and postage, and the letter from OHSU indicated that if this bill passed, you would be able to stop buying supplies and postage. So I wonder if that happens, if this small business would really benefit, because it seems like the increase in that cost would just go into buying supplies and postage, and that there wouldn't really be a real benefit to the employees of the company.
That was my justification for supporting, one of my justifications for supporting this legislation, that we would not continue to provide that service. Now, if it was not offsetting so that they could continue the level of service that they're providing now, we would relook at that. We would have to relook at that.
Further questions?
I understand that you represent a hospital, and there are, 59 hospitals in the state of Oregon, 57 not-for-profits and 2 for-profits. And I'm wondering how many other health care providers there are in the state, thousands, and that this applies to them also. And it goes back to I have a concern about what is this going to cost the state of Oregon. There's no fiscal impact. I have no clue, because I guarantee you the state of Oregon, because they write me checks when we copy records and send it to them. And so I see the issue as very different for an outpatient clinic and for a hospital. And I'm very conflicted. I mean, I will declare a conflict when the time is appropriate, but I think these are issues are much bigger than just the inpatient side, and because there's many doctors out there that have to do this. So I wish we had testimony from the Oregon Medical Association on how this is going to impact their positions, because clearly we make money when we do this. Not a lot, but you know, we're glad to do it. I think we need to address other issues about professional-to-professional disclosure of information, because I get charged, or we charge patients for requests from out of state. And I mean, this issue is—I understand your concerns, but I think it just—it's actually opened kind of a Pandora's box in my own mind about how we do this and what the role of the state is in setting those prices.
Representative, I don't believe that the state fee schedule will change under this Senate bill.
Yeah, the only state agency that pays for copies of medical records is disability, and they have a different fee schedule. This particular fee schedule is for third-party requesters that stand to benefit financially from copies of the medical information. For example, an attorney's office that's requesting records on their client in order to help them with the lawsuit that they're working on. They stand to benefit financially from any ruling that would happen in that lawsuit. Personal injury protection claims, they need copies of their medical record in order to process the claim and give the person that was injured a settlement. So this fee schedule applies only to those requesters. The Oregon administrative rules, as I explained to Mr. Representative Richardson, make up their own fee schedules that they seem to find fair and reasonable, which aren't, and I'm not sure how to get those changed. I'm new at this whole legislative thing, and I'm trying to find the doors how to open Oregon administrative rules to work with the disability people.
If I may respond, the good representative and I have had a conversation, and I think that may need to be addressed. But
thank you. Representative Richardson.
I have a couple of questions and clarification. Mrs. Carlson, as far as OHSU is concerned, is it correct that DBS actually conducts this whole department for you? It's not just filling record requests for outside sources. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so I mean, actually, the whole cost and fee structure is different at OHSU because it's a huge organization, and if obstetrics wants to have records from radiology, it would go through this office. I mean, there's a lot of records that are being fulfilled and a lot of work that's being done that isn't related to just filling outside medical requests. Is that am I correct on that?
That's right. If a request comes into the department, DBS staffs the release of information function, and they're responsible for gathering up the records from the various clinics, the various departments, pulling those together and sending them out to the requester. So the fee schedule is the same regardless of where those records are coming from.
Okay, and follow up?
Yes,
so let me just have a little exchange.
Mm-hmm.
I also, as I was talking with Tracy about this, it was indicated that about half of the record requests are for continuing care. And so if physicians want, medical records, they get that. And my understanding is that there's no cost to physicians for that. Is that
correct? That's correct.
And so what we have then is this many records being fulfilled, half of them are not, there's no compensation for that at all. And then a percentage of them is also for workers' compensation, which I believe workers' comp can charge $10 for the first page and 50 cents for a page after that. And then some percentage also is for disability determination, and they have $18 for the first 10 pages, 25 cents for 11 to 20, 10 cents for 21 to 40, and then nothing after 40 pages.
Right.
My understanding is that almost all the records or all the requests are for more than 40 pages, and so we have a very inadequate scale of what's being paid for workers' comp records, because those fees are controlled in the administrative rules. You really have no control over that. And so now we're down, out of this pile of records, we're down to this many that are actually going to be paid for, and yet those records, those payments, that source of revenue has to carry the weight for all of them, essentially, the difference between what is being paid by the state and the fact that continuing care, half the records are for free. And so what we really have is a huge cost shift to private parties to carry the cost of the whole department, large amount of it, because that's where you can collect. And so the statute is $25 for the first 10 page, 25 cents for every page after that. And the request is, let's go to $35 for the first 10 page and 10 pages and double the fee of 25 cents to 50 cents for every page after that, even if it's 200 pages. I mean, so if you're in a file, and there they all are, and this file has 25 pages, and this one has 250 pages, and it's 50 cents a page, regardless. And why? Because that's what we're being asked to put in the statute. But the consequences of that to individuals is that we're saying to the individuals, because you pay, we need more money to cover all these other costs which are inadequate or zero, and so we want to double the cost. And so that's what we struggle with, is it fair and appropriate to just say 25 cents is not good enough, so let's make it 50 cents a page. And why? Because DBS, and primarily DBS, is not able to make it, although Kaiser has also approached us, and they're saying that they go in the hole in their department and they do it all in-house, but 66% of their copies are for continuing care. And so now you have a third of all of their copies having to carry the weight for everyone. And so it really is coming down to, is that an appropriate thing for this committee to do, to say we're going to double the cost and have the private people pay it because they're the only ones that we can really reach, when maybe it's not 50 cents a page, maybe it's 28 cents a page, maybe it's 34 cents a page, but just to say let's double it, while round numbers are always fun, they mean a lot to people that have to write the checks. And so at the end of this, I would be asking that the matter be set over till Tuesday, because I've requested some additional information both from DBS and from Kaiser on some specific numbers, so that if we make a recommendation that we raise the amount, that it be based on more than, I get an idea, let's double it, and because that's less than what we asked for to begin with, which neither of which is relevant to the reality that this affects the whole state and all providers and everybody that's requesting it.
Representative Richardson, I believe that this fee schedule was based on what our neighbors are doing, what Washington State is doing. It's a reasonable adjustment based on what the research tells us other states are charging. It is true that we don't charge patients who request their records for continuing care or providers, and that does represent half of the volume of the work in our department, but you still have to use the same resources to provide that service free of charge to the patients. So someone somewhere, it has to be shifted, and that's just the nature of the business.
And if I may, Chair, the 40 steps that I submitted that show what the steps are and the costs associated with it was a cost analysis that our company put time and energy into, determining how much it costs to process that request for medical records. And so looking at what the fee is, if my base minimum fee for the most simplest request to go pull this chart, get the discharge summary out, make a copy, mail it, and get it out in the mail is at minimum $30.03, I think is what it turned out to be. If that's the basic, then the $35 charge doesn't seem to be an exorbitant amount of money to ask that we are able to recoup those costs. So the 40 steps, yes, it was our study. I'd be happy to take you all and show you the steps that it takes and the time that it takes to do it. We have 7 people at OHSU that are processing about 150 to 200 requests a day. They aren't getting very much done in one day if it's a quick process. So there's costs associated with it, and that 40 steps shows you the costs.
Well, thank you so much for coming to provide your testimony and the further clarification today. I think we are going to set this over until Tuesday. Are there any other pressing comments or questions before we close the work session? Great. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming.
And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 591. And I'd now like to open a work session on Senate Bill 145A. Thank you.
We have some amendments, and I think Sandy will walk us through those.
I will do my best, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 145 changes the name of the Diversion Program Supervisory Council to Health Professional Program Supervisory Council. It increases the council membership from 5 to 7. You will recall at the last hearing we had two sets of amendments, the A5s and the A6. What you have in your packets are the dash A7s, which have incorporated a request of the chairs into the A6s. So what the A7s do are also, it ensures the confidentiality of the council meetings and the minutes. It protects the client information that, the client information that is revealed in a council meeting that is not relevant should any conversations pursue outside of conversations that are in the minutes. It also set a July 1, 2009 implementation date. The A7 goes further where it clarifies that the members, employees, contractors, past or present, clients of the council are exempt from any disclosure requirements. It also defines examined for the purposes of this bill that, well, on the amendment, it's on the back side, but on the bill, it shows up in a new subsection that is added at the bottom of page 2. I did not do a thorough hand in growth, but there is, I can walk the committee through that if they want any more detailed discussion. And then it also establishes a new implementation date to January 1, 2009. And I do believe that there are the folks here for the last meeting that are here, and hopefully they can respond to the amendments. They got them today, but a little earlier than right before the meeting. So, Kathleen Haley. And
why don't you come on up?
I believe it's...
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz was here. I don't know if...
He's here for 34. We've been asked, sir. The chair would like to be here for that discussion.
Good afternoon.
Welcome. For the record, would you state your name and give us your comments on the amendments?
Yes. I'm Dr. David Watt. I'm chair of the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. Madam Chair, I would like to make a couple of comments on the amendments, which I've only had a few minutes to review. However, I would like to respond to a couple of specifics and then to a general overview of the amendment. Some of the specifics of this amendment appear to be very, very broad in providing a safe haven for clients who have been in the health professional program, and expands the cone of silence, if you will, for confidentiality to anyone associated with the health professional program, past or present, in almost any form, including members, employees, contractors, and clients. As a point of clarification, the health professional program is not a treatment program. It does evaluation and monitoring. Treatment is provided by contracting, well, there are private treaters in the community, but there are many contractors to the health professional program. If this amendment were to take effect, there would be an incredible effect on the ability of the Board of Medical Examiners' investigative staff to investigate complaints against licensees who had had any association in the past with the health professional program. It would not allow investigation for any other complaints. This is a broad area of definition stating that they may not be examined by an investigation, for any investigation. We would very much encourage the expansion, the addition of mental health disorders to the definition of examination, evaluation, and monitoring of the health professional program. However, this, I feel, would actually potentially put citizens of Oregon at risk from licensees who could find a haven from investigation from the Board of Medical Examiners. So that's the specifics that I have on the amendment. The general
question.
Is...
Yes, Representative Richardson.
This is kind of a complex issue because there seems to be a lot of things beneath the surface going on. There's some dissatisfaction with the way things are being done by other people that are part of this process. The question I have relates to the goal of what's trying to be accomplished. If the goal is to have physicians that have some mental issues, whatever they may be, get help, then is that likely to happen if they're going to come to the board and be subject to, you know, having their license affected and consequences that way? In the Bar Association, we have the PLF, Professional Liability Fund, and the State Bar Association, and they're kind of separate. And part of the PLF's job is to, they provide insurance for attorneys, and so they're very concerned about lowering risks. And so one way they do that is by providing 800-247 call if you've got a problem, Mr. Lawyer, and we will help you. If you're addicted, if you can't get things done, if you don't know what you're doing, they've got fix-it attorneys. I know attorneys who feel like they've got an associate there because they get a tough case. They just call and say, I'm in over my head. Can you guys help me so I don't commit malpractice? Absolutely. And so there are ways to assist those lawyers to not commit the malpractice rather than try and pay claims or fix it afterward. And so if the goal is to help doctors who may be addicted or have problems, personal problems, whatever it might be, to get help, then is that likely to happen regardless of what we do with this bill if it's connected to the very board that will be monitoring their competency to practice medicine, where now you've got a secondary consequence. If I call, I could be out of a job, and I don't want to take that risk, and so maybe I can do this on my own. What do you think about that?
The current program, which encompasses substance abuse, the clinical activities of that program are confidential. They are at arm's length to the board. There is an appropriate level of confidentiality for the evaluation and monitoring of that program, with safeguards for those who do not maintain compliance of their treatment programs. It would be a similar situation for mental health disorders. The expansion with this amendment, however, goes well beyond the existing evaluation or monitoring of a particular client, if you will, or a licensee, to the point that if there was a third-party complaint of that licensee that opened an investigation by the Board of Medical Examiners, we would be prohibited from talking to someone who may have had interaction with that person in the community if they had had an association with the health professional program.
Yeah, follow up. That's exactly what I'm talking about, because if your hands are going to be tied because of the goal of trying to get physicians to come forward when they've got problems, then it seems to me you have an inherent conflict between the two goals that the board has. One is to help physicians to, you know, work at their capacity and overcome these problems if they have them, and the other is to assure that patients are well cared for and that we don't risk patients. In the Bar Association, by having them separate, if there's a complaint to the bar investigates that complaint and they proceed doing what they're doing. If there's contact with the Professional Liability Fund on their I Need Help programs, it's not connected, and so they're separate, and so you could actually... If I was an addicted attorney, I could call and say, you know what, I'm in trouble. Come help me. And I know that they're not going to contact the bar and say, are you aware of that? What trouble this guy's in? I mean, they would try and help me solve the problems and get over this and get it worked out without hurting my clients. And so I see this whole circumstance you're in as being almost a catch-22, a situation where you can't do both of those things effectively because the inherent conflict that you have between information you become privy to because of substance or mental or whatever and the goal that you have to watch out for patients. how are you going to, whatever we do, how do you solve both of those problems in an effective way in the same organization?
Representative Richardson, I think you have a good grasp of the situation. It is a balance, and it is the balance that should be able to be reached in the management of, in the internal professional approach to management of healthcare services and licensees by the board. It has it does take a difficult, sometimes difficult approach. However, I think that the approach that has been shown to be successful over the past 16 years in this program would not be changed by the addition of mental health disorders, with the one exception of mental health disorders that include a sexual violation, where that is an obvious risk to patients.
Would that also be breaking the statute, violating the statute? I mean, if the law is being broken, it's a whole different issue.
One of the very positions for you're breaking the law.
Yeah.
And if I may make one more comment regarding this, with all due respect to Representative Richardson, as I believe the source of these amendments is the Oregon Medical Association, which, as I have previously testified, appropriately is representing their constituency of physicians in the state of Oregon. The concern I have is the level of restrictions that this would place on the state agency regarding the potential to investigate complaints of a licensee that may have had some distant association with the health professional program, even though the complaint may not have been directly related to either substance abuse or mental health disorder.
Just a comment to the committee as we go through this. To me, the inherent conflict of the two goals of this board are mutually exclusive. And so by having the board be connected with this, it appears to me that the appearance to the public is going to be, this is an inside deal. They're covering for each other. You know, here I'm aware of this problem that's gone on, and now I call up about it, and I can't find out about it. Because there's these restrictions, and then from the doctor's standpoint, if I go to them because of their supervision over the practice, my practice, I'm in jeopardy of being my license being taken from me, and so I can't risk it. And so I would think that this inherent problem puts a burden on you and the board, that and you as an executive director, which is very difficult because you keep having to change your hat. As to, are we here to help the physician, or are we here to represent the patients, and how do we do both in an effective way? Where I don't see how you can really do that. I mean, I don't care what you've been doing in the past. One of the questions about the DMV is that it looks like an old boy system, and that's been an accusation. I think there's been major improvements in the last few years in opening up, and I really appreciate that very much. But it's still, that's something you have to be careful about. And so I see it.
Chair Greenwick, Representative Richardson, I do think you've hit the nail on the head, and there are only four states, Oregon being one, in which this is the model for the impaired physicians program. So you have really hit the nail on the head for us. The problem with this amendment is that we don't know.
Can you please identify yourself?
I'm sorry, I'm Kathleen Haley, the Executive Director of the Board of Medical Examiners. The problem with this amendment is the board doesn't know about those participants that are in good faith participating in the impaired physicians program. It's at a different site from the board. We don't know who's there, and we have no desire to know as long as they're participating in good faith and in compliance. When they fall out of compliance, they are referred to the board for investigation. Under this amendment, we wouldn't be able to talk to those very people in the community that would have worked with them that could help us in protecting the public. So that's the dilemma we would be in with this current -7 amendments. I think we are closer in looking at an implementation date. I think we're getting closer to the date that would probably work for everybody. I think if we look a year out from now, more like July of 2008 is probably realistic. And in terms of the public meetings law, right now about half of the meeting is administrative and policy and other state business that is appropriately in the public domain. I think if we changed meetings to be exempt, to deliberations being exempt, which would be in keeping with the Attorney General's opinion, I think the board could agree with those changes. I appreciate the opportunity to address you on these amendments, and we'd be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
What's your proposal on the...
My proposal would be
on... dash sevens?
Yes, where? On page 2, if we changed meetings to deliberations, that would be line 12 or 13. And if we did an effective date of July of 2008, and then as Dr. Watt mentioned on page 1, that section, lines 14 through page 2, line 4 would be a problem for us.
Madam Vice Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question would be, what can you live with from lines 14 through on to the next page? Is there anything, what's the most troubling aspect of that? Because I think there is a balance to providing a stronger cone of silence, but not unduly limiting you if there's a specific case. So is it all bad? Is there something in particular? I don't understand your process enough to...
Chair Greenlee, Vice Chair Kotek, I really would like, we were literally handed these as we were walking in the door, and that's a very good question, and I'd like the opportunity to take a look at it and see if there is any part of that that we could live with.
Thank you.
And Representative Kotek, if I also may respond, this series of amendments, I find interesting that they are being introduced at this point, in that the authors of the amendment were also involved in the deliberation and collaboration that led to the original bill. These issues were not brought up at the point of the original writing of the bill. Perhaps it's my lack of involvement in the legislative process and naivete, but this appears to me to be an effort to totally undermine the bill.
Well, wait a minute. Mr. Chairman, not talk about
okay.
Motivation in this. I think
Very well.
If I just might comment, that's helpful to know that it seems that there's stuff that things have been added in. But my impression from the last hearing was post. Discussion of the original bill, it's come to light that there is perhaps some internal issues related between the board and perhaps positions perhaps around this whole program, and so hence where they've come from. So I think this has been something in process, but I can understand why you'd feel that way, but my understanding is new information has come to light with a feeling that this kind of additional structure is needed. So if we could get this worked out, this is extremely important. I would hate not to be able to add mental health. I'd like to see this situation resolved, and I'm glad you're willing to look at the amendments.
Would you be willing to work with them and the
yes
and the OMA folks and see if we can come up with something?
Yes.
We'll come up with an amendment either collaboratively or without collaboratively, and we'll put it on the bill and pass the bill on Tuesday or Thursday. Mr. Gallant, would you like to join this discussion? Here along we've been dealing with that nice Claudia Black, and now we have to...
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm the Associated Executive Director of the Oregon Medical Association. I think 2 days ago, or maybe it was yesterday, my hair was going to go on fire, and now yet again it didn't. So far so good. A couple of things I want to mention, since I think the association has been mentioned by faint praise. We were involved in the dash 7 amendments, as you know, and we have had ongoing discussions with the chair and members of the staff of the BME. The OMA actually introduced the enabling legislation that created this program. We are very serious about protecting the public where you have, in any instance, and particularly finding an effective mechanism to treat physicians who may have alcohol, drug, and mental and emotional conditions. And it's been a critical aspect of the association's philosophy, its policy, and its actions for many years. And I can assure you I've been there many years, so I have personal experience in that. Just as we helped introduce and supported the introduction of the Patient Safety Commission, and I personally managed to get it passed all with $1 of an appropriation, which some have heard me talk about before, but nevertheless, a very important policy and very important for public safety. I believe Dr. Watt would agree with that. I think we should also congratulate Dr. Watt, who's moving to Texas, and will be, in part, working for the Federation of State Medical Boards. I'm sure that his commitment to this arena is sincere, and he'll be as effective there as he
has. You have to have a very high commitment to agree to move to Dallas. You and I have had that conversation already.
But let me get to the bill itself, or the amendments itself. As you know, the way we designed this program, and it seemed like a great idea at the time, was to have an arm's length relationship, try to avoid duplicative administrative costs and that sort of thing, et cetera, et cetera, and that's what we did. Unfortunately, I think there's been some blurring of that. And we have expressed concerns over that particular issue. And these amendments are an attempt to address some of those things. When the HPP is aware that a physician has violated the terms of their agreement under that program, the HPP program is required to refer that individual to the BME. And as I understand it, often the BME takes action, as they should, and they're referred back to the HPP for further work with that individual. So the circumstance you have is individuals who are working with clients, and this program is highly effective, and where you have personnel being examined, are then sent back to the program, and the confidence and patient confidentiality and confidence in the individuals that they're dealing with is significantly harmed. Now, the board gets these reports. They have other avenues of gathering information by subpoena or otherwise to do an investigation, whether it's in other areas or not. This doesn't have to do with any other areas where there are complaints. This has to do with this particular program and whether or not they are in compliance with the program itself.
You've got a bunch of business we need to.
I'm sorry. But anyway, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your support on this and your help in this process. We'll try to come to some agreement. From what I've heard described from the BME at this point, they would get these amendments, which we would not support at this time.
Well, here's the game. We'll get Representative Kotek to meet with you. If she needs any extra muscle, we'll ask Representative Richardson to help her in this. We'll reschedule right now for a week from today, which will be our last meeting. And if you come in with one single amendment that we all agree to, that's what will pass. If you don't come in with each of your amendments, then we'll take a vote, and whichever one passes in the committee, that's the one that will be on the bill, and we'll move the bill with those amendments. So I would hope you can come to some agreement between now and then. It needs to be by, sorry, Representative Kotek got to leave for a minute. He'll be back shortly. It needs to be probably by, be best by the end of business tomorrow, but if not, certainly early on Tuesday, because we need to get the amendments in time for Thursday, and this will be the last meeting of a lot of committees, so we're going to go kind of crazy. But thank you very much. I mean, what you're doing is important. It's God's work. You both know that. And it would be so much nicer if we could make one of those backroom deals that my constituents are always complaining about. And, come to some agreement here.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much, and thank the committee for your tolerance and patience.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We'll close. This is a public hearing, right?
Session.
I mean, a work session. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 145. I just want to make a brief announcement on Senate Bill 144 before we open up 34. After consulting with members of my committee, I've decided we are not going to hear Senate Bill 144 in this session. I would urge the board, if you are serious about adding six different categories of technicians to the regulation of that board, to come up with a proposal in the interim. We'll be glad to work with you on the interim committee if we have anything to say about it, and I think we'll likely be involved, whatever the committee structure is. Talk about how to restructure the board, because the board can't be all red text representing sonographers and MRI and a variety of other things. If you just want to change the name and go the direction you're going now, that's easy. But if you want to add new kind of technicians to the mix, which seems to me is not an unreasonable thing to do, talk to them, think about how to structure a board in a way that they'll feel represented, and let's move that, and I think we can move that probably pretty quickly and pretty early in the next session if that's where we go. So we will not be hearing any further. We will not have a work session on Senate Bill 144, which means it dies here since our last meeting is going to be Thursday, and we'd really be happy to help you work to a conclusion on this so we get it ready for prime time in the next session. And thank you very much all for your work up till now, and stop the emails on both sides. It would be very helpful. So a bit of a work session on Senate Bill 3-4. We have proponents here. Would you like to start the discussion? Senator Morissette, Senator Cruz. Then we have some amendments to discuss. Right. Ms. Myers will be there. Is my amendment there as well?
Yes.
On the 24th?
We got the little seven. Time amendment.
I hope you'll have... Right. We've received a letter from Senator Morissette on some of the issues, but it would be good if you put it on the record here on your sense. In fact, I might have... If you don't have the letter, I might have it somewhere. I saw it earlier.
144.
No, 34.
I mean, 34, not 144.
That's right.
Excuse me. Senator Morissette had some... Yes. Why don't you get
Senator Morissette? That's
I didn't know you could write, Bill.
There's no indication that he's done anything except that X at the bottom.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. I did send out a letter that was hand-delivered, which states, representatives, to get to the point, there are several areas of this agreement that will make this bill unacceptable and will cause the state of Oregon to lose the federal funding for this program if the amendment is adopted. Now, there may be more than one amendment here that falls into that category. Some of the troubling components, specifically the issues of liability and state legal concerns raised by much of the language, will be addressed by the Pharmacy Board Council. The DOJ is here, and he is prepared to address the state's position on some of the amendments. The primary federal grant to the state of Oregon, which would be jeopardized if this amendment were adopted, is based on the inclusion of Schedules 2, 3, and 4 medications. Take some of the medications out, and that it kills the bill. I mean, that ends the discussion. Additional federal funding sources will also require the inclusion of these scheduled medications. The state stands to lose $340,000 in currently awarded to the funding, and forfeit an additional $400,000 grant. The state of Washington, by the way, has already lost their $340,000, and they rely on the future grant. as well, Oregon will be placed in the untenable position, situation of applying for additional federal funds in the future. And we did receive a letter from Karen Wheeler from DAS that enumerated additional federal grant situations related to competitively awarded. And they total around $48.7 million. So there is a lot at stake here. I believe we have until July 1st, and then the door closes on our current funding and possible future funding. So this is an important time. I appreciate your continued patience and your willingness to hear. And we do have the DOJ attorney who will discuss the state's position on this, which is, I think, important for them to say instead of us speculate. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And we're copying the letter to put it into the record.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Yes, Chair, for the record, Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. First, a personal observation I was just thinking as I was sitting back there. I remember when I was in the House and I would go over to testify before a Senate committee and I would wonder, how in the world can they function with such a small committee? And now I come back over here to the House and I'm wondering, how in the world can you function with such a large committee? So,
and my impression is you're right on both counts.
I think I am. Mr. Chair, I've read both the -12 and -13 amendments, and the -13 basically speaks to the issue that we talked about when we were having a conversation with you folks before about wanting this to be live 24/7 program before implementation, and that's perfectly acceptable. That's what we had agreed to, and I think that's...
And the board has no problem with the 13s.
No, and I think that's a very good inclusion. The -12s, Mr. Chair, if you want to kill the bill, that's a very good way to do it. Number one, I don't see how you can parse apart drug schedules the way this intends to do, and the addition of this amendment would have such a chilling effect on those who are wanting to participate. I'm not sure they ever would, and it's seeking protections that are redundant and unnecessary, and the protections are already there. So I too appreciate your continuing work on this issue, Mr. Chair. This program is incredibly important. And Senator Morissette and I have put an inordinate amount of time in on this, and I'm hoping that we can get this done. We need to get this done now. And if you have any additional questions, I appreciate the discussion we had last time we were before you. I just saw the 13s and 12s today, and I have stated my opinion on them, and hopefully it's something you can concur with.
Senator Cruz, is there anything in the 12s that, I mean, is it as a single piece? I had hoped it wouldn't come to us as one piece. Are there some things in there that you think might improve the bill, or at least bring some folks who are skeptical over the side of the angels?
Mr. Chair, some of the folks who have been skeptical about this have been skeptical, and I think no matter what program we have, we'll be skeptical. I think the chilling effect on this may make the program non-viable, and there are people that would like to see this never happen, and I think that's unfortunate, because I think this is a valuable tool for the state of Oregon, and it's good for both providers and patients. And I think the protections that are already written into the bill, the security, the confidentiality, I think all of that is there. I don't think we need to be adding more onto it. I think we have what is needed in the bill and the proper directions in the bill for how we go forward with implementation. So sometimes you can make things worse by trying to make them better, and I guess my judgment is the 12s would do that.
Sometimes you can make it better by trying to make it work.
Yeah.
No. Might also be the case here.
Yeah. We're getting Zen here, and I'm not sure.
Zen?
It's Zen.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I hope that you take the time to hear from the Board of Pharmacy and their attorney, the DOJ, and Pete Shepard was part of our discussion before we came down here, but there, that will, I think, resolve some of the, or at least point out some of the issues that may not be resolvable.
And I think one of the things that was making you wait was, I think we've cleared the deck, so we've got time to take this seriously.
Okay. We're going to have to leave very back to the floor.
You've got a 434, sir.
Senators, I do have one question because there's been concerns about language, and this is the first time I've seen the 13s, but and they don't use the words in this 13, but in conversations the term is real time. Is the information real time? And what does that mean?
What this means, the reason, this is my amendment, and the reason it doesn't say real time is because some of the data that comes into the system will be batch processed. And that means that at the time you address it, if the system's up and live 24/7, at the time you might address it, it might in some instances be a week old. And the real-time sense was that the data would be always up to date, always up to the moment. So I chose not to put real-time in here because of the batch processing of some of the data. Some of the data will be electronically processed. In fact, probably most of the data will be.
Our IT person is here who is designing the system, and he was here last time and didn't give it a check. So he could answer some of your questions.
Right. Well, I just want, if I may, Mr. Chair, have clarification so that that the intent is very clear here, that the information, although you're capable of accessing the database 24/7, that the information, that there may be a lag time before information is available, because, and so that's the intent.
That's definitely the intent of
this. Excellent. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I think we would like to vacate these chairs and put
thank
some smart people in here.
I'm sorry that we held you up. Thank you very much for.
Well, thank you for your consideration.
Okay.
It's okay. I got a copy. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We do want to hear. Let's hear from the IT person. That sounds like a great idea. I mean, Ken, one of the things that makes people nervous is a sense, and this relates to the question of the subsequent referral to Ways and Means that remains on the bill at this moment, is whether you can really produce a system that meets the A13 amendment objectives within the resources that you have to do. And I think we'd all like to hear some sense of your feeling about that. And we'll hear about the mythical man month here in a minute.
All right. Thank you, Chair Greenlick and other representatives. My name is Grant Moyle. I'm president and chief architect of Confuser, Inc., an IT consulting firm. I'm a son of Oregon. I basically grew up in Beaverton, Oregon.
Did you say Confuser, Inc.?
Confuser, Inc., yes. I take computers and make them less confusing.
Great.
So, I'm a son of Oregon. I grew up in Beaverton, graduated from Sunset High School, Eagle Scout, all that stuff. Went off back east to college at Johns Hopkins, studied biomedical and electrical engineering. And since I've been, about that time I started providing health-related licensing boards in the state of Oregon with IT consulting. And basically since around 1992, I pretty much have handled a large number of the state health-related licensing boards and various IT implementation solutions for them. Over the years, we've put many solutions online for those boards, including some licensing lookups using very low-cost, very effective, very secure methods with a lot of read-only data provided to actually sitting out on the web, because that's a lot of the major concern is changing of the data. The model that we envision this product, I was brought on board to kind of help take a look at the technical side, to evaluate what some of the other states are doing, and also to look at it as a fresh standpoint, because I bring to the table a lot of various experience in federal government, military, state and local. I've designed network solutions for large number of companies. I hold credentials in Certified Information Security System Professional, which is an industry standard qualification. I've been a member for 4 years of that, and I've been also highly educated in the Microsoft community, utilizing their solutions and tools and integrating them into custom type solutions. We envision the idea that we get the data from a third party who collects it from the pharmacies. There's several organizations or several companies around the country that provide, that will collect the data from the pharmacies, because that's by far the most time and resource, intensive, correct. It's the most resource intensive component, because we can't employ one person to go visit every pharmacy or integrate directly with their in the systems, you know, to get their data as a prescription is prescribed into the system. What happens is this company will collect all that data for us, for a fee, of course, and then they will provide that data to us in a batch process. And depending on the company, we'll have to put that out to bid, you know, to have which vendor we utilize for collecting that data.
Are these the pharmacy benefit manager database that, no? Okay.
It's a separate solution, yeah. And so they provide the data to us in a batch process.
Some of it they'll acquire electronically?
Yes, some of it they require electronically. Some of it they may for the very small pharmacies. Some of the companies actually will take fax gain records style or, you know, provide that. Something that in-house, and that's really the purpose, why we cannot do the real-time component right away, is the fact that there may be some paper records that, you know, are very time intensive for someone to collect and validate and put into the system. What these companies do is they validate the data by ensuring that, yes, the fields are correctly populated by the pharmacies, if not rejected immediately back to the pharmacy. Then we receive that data basically validated. We take that data, process it, and determine, do we have that person in our system? If we don't, you know, we create the record for the individual, and we attach that prescription to them. So we do that on a processing server that is only available basically to the information technology side of the shop. It's run independently on a system, dedicated server, to taking data from the pulling the data from the outside community, so the outside vendor. We process in-house, locked server, meeting all of HIPAA and other standards. Then we are able to produce what information actually needs to be made available to the physicians. And that's not our decision. That's based on the commission that will be appointed to determine what is the information that will be ultimately, you know, produced on the actual site. At that point, it's moved to a read-only area, a separate server that's read-only, that is web accessible and secured to only authorized persons. So meeting, you know, authorized dispensers and prescribers. That, and that's where the staff of the majority of the staff of the program is involved in making sure that before they grant someone access to that system, they, you know, go through a full credentialing process. Then once they reach that point, they're able to access, log in securely to our website, to our secure website, just like you would process a credit card or anything else like that, utilizing, you know, secure credentials, provide information who you are, and then we'll provide them the information and record everything they do on that site. We can also, logs will be available to program person, the staff position, to validate, you know, to watch for abnormal patterns and so forth. And we'll also have, you know, add components to basically watch for trends.
Mr. Chair, interrupt if I may.
Mm-hmm.
So the one of the concerns of the ACLU was the fact or an ability to track who enters the system, looking for data, and what data they are looking at.
Okay.
And so what you've told me, I believe you're telling me that, in fact, you'll be able to achieve that result.
If it is desired, and we're required by the federal grant to do so under HIPAA laws and other things, that we must record who has access to that information.
Okay, so that's
the who has access? Who accessed it?
Sorry, who accessed? Yes, who accesses the record?
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Tell me about budget now.
Okay.
You think all this can be done?
Yes, I believe so.
And it can all be done.
Correct.
It can be done, yes. A large portion of the budget actually goes into basically gathering all the data, which is something that we will utilize a third-party company for that collects the data from the pharmacist to validate the data and bring it to us.
Can you make a guess at how much per year that might cost?
My understanding, the existing companies, by the state, based on some information I have from the state of Illinois and a few other states, around $6,000 to $7,000 a month to collect that data. So, less than $100,000 a year to gather that data.
A couple hundred thousand dollars for a biennium for that.
Well, 144, yeah. If it was, say, if we, you know, determined at $6,000 a month.
And if you determine it was $7,000, which nothing ever comes in the lower estimate.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's where we have several companies to basically receive bids from to get the best cost-effective component of that.
Let's say $170,000. Now, how about designing the system and putting it up?
Basically, to design the various components, I've taken the system and broken it down. First part is to basically the data, bringing it in, importing, and verifying the information. You know, the data that comes from the provider, so our vendor. That we're looking at about a $10,000 solution is initially in my piece to develop basically a dedicated software package on that server. So we have in our budget the server money to handle it, and then we also have IT component to do it. And the idea is we'll bring the data in, process it, determine, you know, do we already have a record for that person or do we not, and to attach the prescription information to that.
And you're talking about $10,000 for the development of the...
Of the first, the processing server, the component to bring the data in and process it, determine, do we have a, you know, do we have an entry for this person, and attach records to it.
Do you have a price for that server?
A server about $5,000. As typical, I like to utilize several different servers, you know, basically divide and conquer is the method I tend to use, both from a security standpoint and from a technical and simplicity standpoint as well, because what it allows you to do is have dedicate resources to one particular task.
And no ongoing maintenance for that.
Correct. Server. Well, every few years that server will need to be upgraded, just like your home computer.
If you need a couple of them, it'll be $10,000 for the two
yes.
servers.
But for that particular stage, since that is batch processing components, we're able to take the data in and process it on that server. And, you know, should that server become non-functional, that does not affect the real-time availability of the information on the web publication server. This is the processing, so our batch processing.
And you don't need redundancy at that point?
Correct. We would, you know, like to have redundancy, but we are also eligible that if this is passed to apply for additional grants towards the program, you know, so get up and running, you know, server to process that information should be more than adequate, given what I can purchase currently, you know, through state contracts from HP or other vendor.
And you don't have any contract at this place in the development of any of those systems?
No, I do not.
I mean, the Sorry. Development of those systems are going to basically be free?
Sorry?
The development of...
That's where my $10,000.
That's the $10,000.
There's the development of the software right. component to bring in data,
all right.
process it, and determine it.
And how about on the web-based side?
Okay. Then on the web-based side, because it's a matter of the web-based component, we're looking at probably about $20,000 worth of development time in addition to one to two servers. One is the minimum, obviously, but in order to help address the 24/7, the ability to utilize additional servers would be beneficial, and that is where, you know, additional grants can be obtained or, you know, a backup server to provide it 24/7.
And is there any other system you want
to use? Actually, then there will be another system internally that is a recording and logging, because you do not do your recording and logging and your authentication on the server that people actually hit. From the security standpoint, because if somebody, somewhere at the point, there has to be a point that the outside world interfaces with this server. That's on the web server. You don't let that web server have the list of who is allowed to access it. Because if somebody grabs a hold of that, or heaven forbid, put their own name into there, you have a major security risk. So what you do is you put the interface where the outside user, so the physician, the provider, the dispenser, interfaces with it. That server goes and asks an internal server that is not accessible from the internet, do I let this user in? And when they do that, we also make a record of, you know, them accessing the data. And, you know, and also utilize that as the authentication. So we know person X logged in, and we know a record was accessed. And that information is held within a separate server. And that development of that is another server, because I would much prefer to use standard off-the-shelf type technology, you know, the server class, rather than building humongous monster one because the time it takes me to buy a four-processor server, I can buy typically 3 to 4 two-processor servers to do it. Just like, you know, you can buy a home computer, and then you always wonder why are we spending, you know, $1,000 at the office. Well, we get one with a little, you know, more technology in it. We find a nice balance of the cost versus benefit of what we can do. And so there'll be an internal server that basically is queried. And the development for a software, a database to keep track of who is authorized into the system, and also, you know, so the credentialing phase, that's about another $10,000 development cost on the inside. There's about $40,000 worth of software development costs in there. And then about, you know, starting a minimum of 3 servers. And so $15,000 worth of technical hardware.
So then your testimony is if you were bidding this whole thing,
mm-hmm.
you could bid that for $60,000.
Well, I would bid the software development side. The group would directly purchase the hardware. And that way I prefer not to get involved in those conflicts where I'm selling something that I'm actually installing. I'll make my recommendation through price, you know, so they can obtain it through the price agreement. And my experience with this, has been that I've worked with this very small health-related licensing boards for the last, about 16 years. And my solutions, while they tend to be very low cost, tend to be some of the more durable ones within the state. So they tend to basically provide the resources they need, and we do it, you know, where we have the small budget. And we have, you know, my smallest group that I work with is a 0.3 full-time employee, and some of my larger ones, the Oregon Racing Commission and the Pharmacy Board, where I basically help them with their IT solutions.
And what would you estimate the number of prescriptions in that database a year?
Those numbers, I can't remember off the top of my head, and I'm sorry, I don't have my note on that.
Magnitude?
Well, I could easily see our system handling 10 million plus in a simple design because we're looking at 1 million prescriptions a month. Average size of a record, and if we take what does it take to store a prescription in a database, we think about it as one kilobyte per prescription in a record. So 10 prescriptions would be 10 kilobytes, 100 prescriptions would be 100 kilobytes, 1,000 prescriptions would be 1 megabyte. 1 megabyte is what we're used to on the old floppy disks. So then we go to 10 megabytes for 10,000 prescriptions, 100 megabytes for 100,000 prescriptions, a gigabyte per 1 million prescriptions. A gigabyte is the sort of thing that you'll have in your standard computer these days. You purchase off the shelf, and so that's actually sitting in memory. If you bought a hard drive recently, you probably looked at the 300 gigabyte or 500 gigabyte. So the amount of data we can actually actively process is very large these days, and so the scale of the needs for this are easily in the tens of millions of records we could handle prescriptions per year, and I believe that fits with the numbers.
Expect 1 million or 2 a year,
Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm not on a Ways and Means Committee, so this is a really great opportunity to get into that.
Part of the question is, does this need to go to Ways and Means?
I understand, and that's why I appreciate the opportunity. My only question goes back to the $170,000 figure that you gave for acquiring sort of the data in the first place. This would be contracted to an outside company. Did I understand that correctly? And now, was that a one-time cost?
No, that is there's an ongoing cost? Monthly cost.
Yeah, go ahead.
I apologize.
I'm
new to
$85,000.
That is a $6,000 to $7,000 per month cost for them to actively be interacting with the pharmacies and to gather the information for us. Something we could not do with a single employee, you know, just to sit there and constantly just handle it. So there's several companies that other states utilize for this that interact with the pharmacies to collect the data, whether it be through electronic or other mechanisms. And so with our initial funding, if we go, you know, the plan is to go live on July 1 of 2008, we have a year, you know, within that funding. You know, so the initial $340,000, my understanding is for the first, you know, to be up and running through the first biennium.
Thank you.
Senator Brew?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When this gets up and running, assuming we pass this and gets up and running, is there a point at which you become indispensable? You have a vast array of technological background on this, and my worry is that you become indispensable.
Okay. To address that, we'll be utilized. My recommendation would be to utilize off-the-shelf standard database technology, either Microsoft SQL Server or Oracle, and whether I develop it or we, you know, the licensing board contracts it out for the development of components. That's the idea of the modular system, where there's components that are, you know, rather than it being one monster program, we instead have these various components that can easily be understood by most database developers. So someone
you
with
get a
SQL
great script. Job offer in Maine, and you leave in 2 days, and we've got no problem. No security problems or no technological problems.
Correct. Well, I would be under if I was the one awarded, I would be under contract for a fixed amount of time with the licensing board to continue to operate. And once the development costs are there to incrementally add components through these federal grants to receive the monies from these federal grants, you know, we're able to basically enhance our program. And it doesn't have to be done by a single program. And there
you
is
have a
capability.
Monthly maintenance charge for that?
Would I? Most of my boards, I actually do a hourly basis on what I'm doing for them. I tend to be able to give them a predictable IT costs. But as far as hourly, we haven't, as what would the expected per month would be, until we fully have the system and what the specifications, what the commission would like, but I would not see that exceeding more than 5 to 10 hours a month of IT professional time. The moderate.
Great. All right. Thank you very much.
Security issues are huge.
Yes.
Okay. And you've worked with the military, is that correct?
Yes, I've worked with. DISA, the Defense Information Systems Agency, providing web security and other training throughout the facilities. I have not had classified experience. I integrate in with. I basically provide training resources.
Okay.
You have classified.
He told you he'd have to kill you.
I want to find out whether we're going to put you in charge of this or not. Representative Cote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's been some discussion about patients, people with prescriptions, being able to take their information out of the database. So my understanding would be is once the system is up and running, there is someone staff trained at the board that someone could contact and say, take me off the list. Is that what would be, or could they do that themselves if someone wanted to take themselves off the list? I'm just wondering how that might
be. I'm a technical resource, so I don't know that I can address that question for you. So I would have to defer it to.
I want to call Ms. Myra next and talk about some of these amendments.
Chair and Representative Kotek, it's not so much a list. It's more, I assume that your question goes to perhaps, correct me if I'm wrong, if there is perceived to be an error somewhere. Is that your question? Yes. Okay. So the only way that an error in the data can occur is for a misfill at the pharmacy to occur, meaning that upon a prescription being filled in the pharmacy is when the data is created. And therefore, in order for that to happen, a prescription would have to be presented and filled in correctly at the pharmacy and purchased and walked away with by the patient.
If they have an electronic system.
No matter what. The only way that an error can happen in a pharmacy is if there is a misfill of a prescription. And then a week later, let's say, that data, if it was never caught in that week's time.
Wait. We're talking about going out and gathering data from pharmacies that don't have data systems.
Correct.
There isn't any room for a transcription error at that point?
A transcription error.
Okay. In evaluating the companies that can actually provide the data to us, they sort of limit that they will be a maximum of 25 records per. One of the ones I evaluated was that they would provide X number of records per month could be filled manually on paper, and that they go through extra extent. But I could see where the question, if that paperwork at that point was misfilled, so we can work. You know, from my standpoint, if to address that, we would work with the vendor to basically provide a flag that if a data record was brought in was entered manually rather than an electronically received record, that there could be additional steps we can take on the validation.
But there are other errors at hand, right?
But if there is an error,
I can get a prescription filled under Mitch Greenlick or Merwin Greenlick or MR Greenlick.
Correct. And in fact, that's one of the most troublesome pieces about any database system is the creation of duplicate records or accidental combination of two records. To address that, we would much, in the interest of this system, the commission would set a threshold as to the minimum number of connections. You know, if we think about fingerprinting, you know, there's certain, you always see them on the television that, you know, talking about a certain number of points within the fingerprint. We're going to maximize the number of points that must be matched based on, you know, my recommendation to the commission would be to maximize the data points. And if we end up with two records for you, that it would actually exclude you from the system rather than, you know, make it look like you had a double dose. So if you wind up with two records in our system, what we have there is, you know, because you it was you had provided a different birth date or something like that, you would have two completely different records, each with less than the prescription amounts.
And perhaps it would be helpful to note as well that we have learned that the software capabilities have increased tremendously in, for example, bringing together aliases, which is the term that we would use if people are using a variety of names out there to doctor shop and that sort of thing, and that these data points are successful in bringing forth and correlating perhaps two different profiles.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So, thank you. So if there are these data points that they're matching up, I live in a small community where there are a limited number of physicians, so the likelihood that my primary care doctor who writes my prescriptions, it's very high that my neighbor has the same one. In fact, in my office, we all have the same primary care physician. We didn't organize that. So you have two people named Barbara Hansen in the same town. Maybe they live in the same neighborhood. They see the same doctor. They have the same prescription, prescription and the same condition.
Mm-hmm.
How do you avoid matching up those data points and collapsing those records together? And if they are collapsed together, how does that person even know that that's happened in order to request the correction if there's been an error?
Mm-hmm. I'll let you take that.
The date of birth in there is an important factor of a pharmacy record.
Mm-hmm.
And basically we have, you know, the information, name must match, and as you said, name could be the same, address, because that is typically on the, or that is on the, that is one of the prescribed fields on the information coming in.
So the information on a prescription blank that is required to be on a controlled prescription gives you a number of data points, and certainly all of them would not overlay name, date of birth, address, phone number, prescriber, etc., all the way through.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I once had a woman friend who said any woman that would tell you her birthday would lie about other things, too.
And I can understand the birth date as a protector there, but even on the address, I'm again thinking in my legislative district we have a university, and so many individuals would have exactly the same address. They probably are going to the same prescriber. They may have the same telephone number if they live in the same fraternity, and if they're both Stephanie Smith. I really hadn't thought about this part of the danger of collapsing records into each other. I understand the concern about wanting to be careful of aliases. However, I wouldn't want the wrong Stephanie Smith to be denied access to her needed medication. And so this has raised an area of concern that I did not have 10 minutes ago, but it's fairly concerning to me now.
Yeah, the key is the primary field that, you know, as you know, as date of birth is one of the key pieces in here. The problem actually would have actually happened well before, because the pharmacist may have in fact been confused by the prescriptions attaching the record even before it even gets to us. You know, as you can imagine, so there are a lot of mechanisms that are in place in the physician's office as well as in the pharmacy. We're going to take the data, and my recommendation to the commission would be that we match all data points. And I would much prefer in the system to see multiple records for that person rather than trying to collapse them into one. Or in that particular case, as done by some of the other states, they will actually kick a questionable record and have the staff person validate that information as it comes in from the data.
And perhaps I could add, too, that pharmacists have, in this world of technology, we have had to become extremely accurate because we bill constantly, constant adjudication. We get those data points correct because it will kick back immediately from all the billing systems of the third-party payers that are out there. And so it's not like maybe 10 years ago where we were pretty good at it. We're real good at it now, and our staff is excellent at it. They have to be, or we'd have everything being kicked out constantly.
We do need to move on. Yeah, let me ask this one last question. There was two FTEs in the budget, is that what?
Correct. Originally there were.
And mm-hmm. What's the total price of the two FTEs?
And I'm sorry, I'm not the budget person, and I don't have that in front of me. She's having surgery today. Do you have that?
Yeah, I have. Yes, I believe I do. What I asked is, when I was brought on board to the project, I was asked basically, you know, to determine, you know, initially to start this up, one full-time employee would be, as things have changed, because originally, in fact, on Monday, there was talk of a phone-based system originally. that would require more staff initially to get up and running. Mm-hmm. Here, the majority of the first development portion is the IT component. So there's one basically staff, then the other portion of that full-time employee is where a lot of the components of the cost to develop the system are. So within the first year, there's one full-time employee, and then I believe it goes in the subsequent biennium into two full-time employees. So I believe the original cost was salaries and wages. In the PDMP GRB budget, I had $133,000, and that's actually dropped down on a 414.
It's 207 total is what we have, 208.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, with the professional service total.
Is that a biennium?
Yes. Yeah, so the initial startup costs are only for our first biennium, and we have that another column that revised. I don't know if I have the same piece of paper. Yeah, I believe. $163,000 in there.
So they average about $40,000 a year in salary. Is it one FTE and then two?
I believe it's only two FTEs.
It was two FTEs total, mm-hmm. or in the I believe in the original.
In the second year, there'll only be one FTE and one FTE in the first year.
Correct. I believe that's how that is being adjusted.
Well, in the initial for the initial through 2008.
That's not what we heard.
Sorry?
We heard before that at least at one time there would be two FTEs in place at the same time.
Yes, my understanding is that starting 2009 to 2011, to get the system up and running, there's going to be a lot of IT involvement component and a staff member. The actual need to have someone on the phone answering calls has been replaced with a live system that can be accessed.
The 24/7.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Can I call Andrea Meyer?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
While she's coming up, I would think that the Dash 12s actually have some pretty good ideas in them and that they're not all bad. One of them is that if a patient feels that there's been inaccurate information put on his or her record, that they could contact the board, and then the board's job would be to ensure that there's a correction rather than have to have them traipsing around to pharmacies. Well, I'm sorry, this guy went out of business, or his records are gone, or whatever. They could call the board and get that corrected because they would have the ability to oversee that wherever it needs to be done because they can have control over the system. And so I think there's a number of things that were actually pretty good in the Dash 12s, and if there's problems with them, they ought to be looked at each of the changes individually, merely saying throw them out wholesale.
That's what I'd like, Ms. Manning, to walk us through them, so we can talk about the possibility of picking pieces out and then making the edits to them as individual pieces. Go for it.
Chair Greenlit, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I think I'm going to operate on last things first, so I want to touch on a few things that you've just heard testimony about. You have spotted one of the concerns, which is unique identifiers, and Representative Gelser spoke about a small town. I'd also be concerned about a large town with John Smith and same birth date. There are a lot of common names that can't use Social Security number. So it is a concern, and it is a concern that someone will get flagged by their pharmacist or a doctor that they have multiple prescriptions. So I think it's something that we continue to need to look at, and it's a concern. The gentleman, I'm sorry, I don't remember his name, but the IT person, I wanted to respond also. He spoke of multiple servers. I just note it's interesting that in a piece that the Board of Pharmacy has provided relatively recently this year, they quote, the BOP will own and house the server and only authorized staff will have access to the system. Information will only be housed in the in-house computer. That's not what we're hearing now. We're hearing about multiple servers. More importantly, he discussed how he got to the numbers that he brought today in his budget. And he reviewed, he said, among other things, Illinois. Illinois does not have the system that you're looking at in port planning. And that's where I would direct your attention to the sheet that I just gave you. And I'm substantiating the testimony I'm giving on this and something else in a moment from the Bureau of Justice Assistance Prescription Drug Program. This is the folks who do this. Illinois only does Schedule 2. And my research in looking at their law was it was only for law enforcement and licensing investigation purposes only. It is not used by providers and pharmacists. I believe they have legislation, and it may be going through, I don't know. But when we look at how much Illinois costs, this is apples and bananas, not apples and apples.
Mr. Chair, with all due respect, Ms. Meyer, Are you a computer expert? Do you understand? I mean, because when he says server, I understand it differently, and I don't mind comparing other states' systems, but I think it would be, I'm not sure you're qualified to make those comparisons yourself. And if you want to bring someone, I think, with computer experience, I think that would be helpful. Because I think we're trying, I mean, he's an expert, and granted, they might be different systems, but I'm not sure that, I wouldn't mind hearing that testimony, but I'm not sure you're the right one to give it.
Oh. Representative Greenlick, Representative Kotek, I'll make 2 points about the cost. Yes, I am not an expert. What I was saying was that the Illinois program does not provide for pharmacists or prescribers to get the data. You can decide. I'm not speculating on what the cost is going to be. It may be the same cost.
Mr. Chair, may I just clarify? And I'm not, and I understand that point. I think it's not who accesses it, but how they access it. And if the type of interface is the same, that's the issue, not whether or not it's a law enforcement or a pharmacist. And I'm just trying to make the differentiation here that it's the technique and how the process is accessed, not necessarily who's accessing it. But I understand that in that state, it's different people accessing it. I'm not taking issue with that.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, and only for controlled substances, too. Well, let's talk about Kentucky. That's the only one I have data on. They have gone real time, and I want to qualify that. So, because we've talked about different things. My reading, it's real time for doctors and pharmacists. It still will take 15 to 20 days to enter. It costs them $1.5 million to start it up. Excuse me, $1.4 million. And they got from the general fund an ongoing enhancement of $5 million for in security, safety enhancement, systems enhancements. That's the word I read, system enhancement. In other words, what I'm saying basically today is, you've heard something. This is brand new. This is different than what they've been providing in information. It's a little frustrating to me, and I'd hope to you all, with the $50,000 grant they had, that this has not been brought forward, vetted, even got different kinds of systems so that you could really understand that. I am very skeptical that the cost is going to fit tightly and neatly under what the federal grant is. That's my point here. We need to be very critical about what version you want, what services you want, and whether you're really going to be able to purchase that with that money. I'd suggest Kentucky could not with the same kind of program, full schedules, and to providers. Also, you heard earlier, in much earlier testimony, that the federal grant will be jeopardized if we remove certain schedules because it's required to be scheduled 2, 3, and 4. Again, I'm relying on the Bureau of Justice's information. They have a grid here. I can tell you that it reflects that there were a number of grants awarded to states that have only Schedule 2 or Schedule 2, 3. It's reflected in the sheet I gave you. Those are, I'm not sure that there's any state that has this program that does not have a grant. As you note at the bottom, there was number of states listed at the bottom that have received grants but have no law. There's been suggestion that you will lose millions of dollars in other areas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's a really important point about the funding, and so I was wondering if we could also have someone from the board up here and answer that particular question. I think your suggestion of taking out certain drugs is not necessarily a bad one, but I think it's problematic if it affects the funding. And so could we hear from the board on that particular issue?
If we may.
Mr. Chair, yeah. While they're coming up, if Ms. Meyer, if you could explain the basis for, what's the reason for taking out those drugs?
Well, I'd like to go to my amendments and go through them all and walk you through them. And if I can represent bottom each, it's okay for me to hold that.
Sure.
You've had the floor. You started this.
Mr. Chair, I think if we have Department of Justice that might be able to shed some light on this, I think it would be appropriate also.
More the merrier.
My point on this was that I do not believe grants are jeopardized, that they have issued grants. Now, maybe they've changed the rules. I cannot find that. But they've issued grants to many states that do not have 2, 3, and 4.
Say something.
Yep.
This sounds like a rebuttal, but without evidence. I mean, instead of saying other states have some grants, can you show us where there's something that says that what they've said is wrong? I mean, it's...
Well, that's...
That's
They haven't said anything yet. It was Senator Morissette that said it.
Chair Grant, Representative, this is new information I'm hearing for the first time today. I do actually have the documentation, but it's a rebuttal for a case that I didn't know I was arguing.
Was the contract requiring us to include 2, 3, and 4?
Representative Greenlick and committee, the way that our grant is written, it does require the state of Oregon to include Schedule 2s, 3s, and 4s. And
please
that,
introduce yourself again.
I'm so sorry. Paige Clark, Oregon Board of Pharmacy, Pharmacist Consultant. Thank you. Our grant is structured and written so that it requires the state of Oregon to include Schedules 2, 3, and 4 medications. And in doing so, that is how the grant, the 350, now 340 remaining, is granted to the state of Oregon.
That's what you said you were going to do?
Exactly. That is how that was structured.
But they required you to say you were going to do those.
And if the state of Oregon does not include those things, we will not be able to go forth in the future and request federal funding, because the federal additional grants require that you have those components in them. The states that have quite a bit of history in this, and perhaps...
Sorry, there are grant regulations now that require 2, 3, and 4 be included in the grants?
There are grants out in the future that will require that to be very...
There are currently grant regulations out that say future grants will require 2, 3, and 4.
There is language saying that our current grant that we have awarded to us is structured so that 2, 3, and 4 will be included
but
in
that.
But
that's because that's what you put in. Your
correct.
Request.
That is because that's how that is structured, and that's how that
my
was awarded.
My question was a straightforward one. You're asserting that future grants depend on having 2, 3, and 4. Is there some documentation that includes that?
We can get that for you, that yes.
Would,
absolutely.
Great.
I will get that to the committee, of course. Yes.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask a clarification on that? Is that, Ms. Clark, because the first grant application included those, or is it because of some other reason?
Correct. The first grant included that, and we were advised by the National Council on State Legislatures to do so, and those states that have history in this and maybe originally started out with maybe including just twos or twos and threes are rapidly moving toward inclusion of all of them because of the requirement that has been put forth by future federal grants.
Yeah, it'd be useful for us to see those requirements.
Sure.
Jay, you have anything to say about that?
Tom Cowan for the Department of Justice, Chair Greenlick. Our only concern on this is to define controlled substance in a way that's inconsistent with other acceptable definitions. It's not recommended, and therefore we would expect there to be a strong policy rationale to deviate from an accepted definition.
What's the definition of controlled substance?
I can't recite it to you, but I know that it includes the substances that are excluded below it here.
Chair, so you're saying there's a definition for class 2, for class 3, and class 4, and to exclude drugs out of that is messing with the definition that we have in statute.
Right.
Okay.
And when it comes to...
But we could exclude class 4, say.
Oh, absolutely.
Without screwing around with the definition.
And actually, you have the authority to exclude these, but it's not recommended to use definitions inconsistent with federal law and state law that already have working definitions of controlled substances. Does that respond to your question, sir?
Well, there's working definitions, and then there's a list of things that are included under those working definitions.
Correct. And the accepted, let me put it this way, the definitions that are in use in federal and state law include these substances that are excluded under the draft language.
Somebody brought me a notebook. It's about this thick that has a list of drugs under 2, 3, and 4. And you're saying to me that the definition by inclusion has all the things on those 30 pages of list or whatever that is?
I'm not sure that I understand the question.
I understood you to say that the definition includes the examples of the drugs, the list of drugs themselves. And I'm saying I just got from the pharmacy, from a pharmacy source, a notebook that has thick lists of here's the list of twos, here's the list of threes, and here's the list of fours, because I asked to see that. What I thought I heard you say is that if you take seven lines out of seven of those pages that make up list two, Category 4, then you're destroying the definition of what Category 4 would be?
No, I'm saying that your definition, if you accept the draft language, will be inconsistent with other definitions of applicable law that are out there, because these listed...
The definition of applicable law includes a list of drugs. Is that what you're saying? The list of the drugs currently named a Class 4 drug defines what Class 4 is? Is that what you're telling me? And if you take four of them out, you've destroyed the definition of what Class 4 is?
Well, I wouldn't use the word destroyed, but it would make...
What would you use?
I would say that the definition in the draft language would be inconsistent with the working definition of controlled substances in federal and state law.
Chair Greenlick, may I? I'd love to continue if I may. I wanted to say one last thing about the fiscal, the March fiscal from the Board of Pharmacy through LFO.
Just a few minutes ago through your amendment.
Right.
So if you want any of us to have any sense of what you're talking about, I urge you to get on to the amendment.
It allocated $256,000 for personnel. I'd be very concerned. I want to go through the amendments. I know you have the engrossed version. I noted on something else. I'm going to try to walk it along. The reason, the rationale for the first amendment on controlled substances was that the focus of this, the documentation, has always been regarding pain and pain abuse. And so these drugs listed here are the it's Ritalin, Xanax, Ambien, Lunestra, all the sleep hypnotic aids.
Mr. Chair, I that's not the testimony that I've heard. It's not about pain. It's about substances that are abused and sold on the street and attempting to control those abuse situations and illegal selling of drugs.
Chair Greenlight, Representative Maurer, I'm relying, and I'm sure their testimony may include more, I'm relying on their materials and their educational materials on this matter. But you wanted the rationale. That was the rationale. These were sweep in children. These sweep in a lot of people. The next amendments.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm sorry. So on the ones that are excluded in the amendment, it seems like it includes things even with children. So Ritalin, for example, and the derivatives of Ritalin, those also are abused and sometimes taken by family members for whom the child has been prescribed, and they basically take them, sell them, use them. So I still don't understand the rationale for excluding.
Chair Greenlight, Representative Gels here, but if someone was doing that, I'm not sure that this system would ever catch that. If I am a parent and my child has a Ritalin prescription, we go every day or every 30 days, we get a refill. And instead of giving it to my kid, who doesn't know the difference, I use it or I sell it. I'm following my one doctor, I'm getting my prescription refilled, and I'm using it on my kid. So the frequent use of Ritalin, I hear, is sort of the misuse of lawful obtained prescriptions, not a lot of shopping, but...
Can I follow up?
Yep.
I think that, actually, sometimes in those cases, the shopping can be increased because a person that's abusing that may have three kids that they take to multiple doctors, or they lose the prescription, and then they go and they get a new refill to fill those others. So what that could do is be pinging on those data points that in this family all of a sudden we're filling and refilling Ritalin prescriptions or a similar prescription. And I just picked on the Ritalin because you mentioned children. I was confused when I saw these because some of the drugs that are excluded in the -12s are some drugs that are very concerning in terms of abuse either by the individual that's getting them or in terms of the resale value having them out on the street.
Well, Chair Green, the Representative Gelser, absolutely. And I assume controlled substances 5, which aren't included in this, have some addictive and misuse concerns too. So it's where you choose to draw the lines. What I was getting at was excluding the kid issue and excluding the drugs that didn't go to the pain, which had been a lot of the attention that I've heard over the years on this. I want to move quickly along. My second change is...
Let me comment on that. We keep hearing the reason we're doing this is because we want to make sure that people with chronic pain are able to get their medication. That's been the one argument that I've heard.
Pain docs.
Fairly consistently.
Right. Greenlick, that's the pain commission, that's the pain doctors, that's the ER doctors giving pain meds. So I know there are other uses and it could be expanded, but I...
Well, but the flip side of that is the reason we have to make sure the folks who shouldn't be getting their meds get them is because people are abusing them, which means people are selling drugs. So there's they're related. They're not necessarily incompatible goals. So.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, I just want to state for the record that the reason I did this is because millions of Oregonians, hundreds of thousands of Oregonians who are doing nothing wrong will be databased. And that is a troubling concern if there was a day to reduce that. That was what I was looking for. Indeed, I just want to clarify. I met with Representative Kotek at the last hearing that I testified and asked me to prepare sideboards. That's what I've done. This was not an intentional, let me try to kill it with love or pain. I've tried to go through. The only thing I could not do was allocate sufficient funds for a database. And I continue to be extremely alarmed and hope you'll be very cautious at recognizing the need to fund that. But that was the intention of this. And so I'd like to walk you through them all. But I just wanted to clarify, and you'd asked me to put them in one amendment.
Absolutely. I asked you, and because I think we should examine the different things we might want to change. And this is our opportunity to have this give and take of what seems to work and what might not work. And so, keep going.
My second change was the requirement that the board may contract with another state agency, but not with a private entity, to ensure the effective operation of the database. The concern was database security.
Could you help us follow either on the engrossed?
Okay, if you're on the engrossed 12A, 12B, 12C, and I will try to. So is everyone working off of the engrossed? Because I was working off the amendments, I can work off the engrossed.
Yeah, work off the amendments, whichever.
No, you guys work off the engrossed, I'll match it.
All right, you're down to the first page now.
12A, 12B, 12C, it was a database secure. Again, I relied on testimony from the Bureau of Pharmacy that they would use their own in-house server and authorized staff. If you turn the page. 24A and downward are two things. This is intended to cover, as a patient, I'd like to know when I'm meeting with...
Sorry, what page?
Oh, I'm sorry. Chair, it's page 1A in your engrossed version. And it starts out 24A. Before a patient receives medication authorized, they need to be notified it's entered in the database, as well as when there's a search. The reason is I think we're entitled to know when we're going to get a prescription that could be databased. We may want to talk to our doctor and say, you know what, I really feel uncomfortable about that. Is there a different drug that I can take that will not get me in this database? And I'm not talking about people who are trying to, you know, drug abusers. I'm talking about many people who may be very uncomfortable with that. And that's the opportunity for them to talk to their doctor about this. And if they have any questions. And when the pharmacist runs it, that too should be a time when they're notified that someone's running, or the doctor running a report on you. I think you should know. It doesn't require you to consent. Other states have a consent requirement. One state does on that list. So this is not actually really novel stuff. It's already one state requires patients to be consent, and which is more than I'm saying here. Virginia was the law. The final on that was a patient may review the information in the database about the patient every 6 months at no cost. I wanted to ensure that you will really have access. You will not be charged an inordinate sum, and you will have it sort of like your credit report. You'll have access every 6 months. I would imagine very few would take advantage of that. If you'd be kind enough to turn the page.
Mr. Yep. I think this is actually some really helpful language that we should have here. The one thing we might want to change, though, when we amend this is this section is dealing with sets of criteria that the board, it's talking about the rulemaking process. And so I'm wondering if we want to write these in a different way that says what we're trying to make sure appears in the rules versus maybe identifying it this specific. I'm just saying this is a rulemaking. This is guidance for the rulemaking. And so, but I hear what you're saying is that there should be prior notification, that there should be ability to access it, you know, at no cost. Those kind of, we might want to think about.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, in the current bill, they have patients will be notified. They just don't tell you when. I'd like to point out that, again, I'm taking some of these ideas from other law. They're in statutes. Virginia has it. So.
Okay.
I'm a little suspicious about the 6 years on this adventure. I would rather see things in statute. Number five. Okay, you're on page two. That's 18A through 18C. I simply wanted something that said we comply with HIPAA and Oregon privacy laws. I've heard different things in the back of the room from folks about whether Board of Pharmacy is under HIPAA. Regardless, this board has testified over and over again that they want to follow the privacy protections. I thought, let's just put them in the law and make it crystal clear. Number six is 22A and 22B. Let me explain this whole context. The current law is written, allowed a doctor to obtain your records regardless of whether they were considering or about to prescribe you a controlled substance.
Any doctor.
Any doctor. It is the line, you're on page 2, it's the current lines 19 through 22, part of which is removed. To a practitioner or pharmacist who certifies that the requested information is for the purpose of evaluating the need for providing medical or pharmaceutical treatment for a patient to whom they anticipate providing care. So the purposes of the amendment there is to make sure it's only when the doctor is considering prescribing you a controlled substance. You go into your doctor for something entirely unrelated. I don't think it's appropriate for a doctor to run your database on controlled substances. So that, or the pharmacist, for that matter, if you have a relationship with your pharmacy and you're getting, you know, reproductive health care, or you're getting your diabetes, or whatever medicine you're getting that has nothing to do with these controlled substances, that should not be a cause for them to get a report on you.
What about the interaction of drugs?
Chair Greenleg, Representative Richardson, it's never been my understanding that the purpose of the database is to help doctor to provide that we make sure we know what patients are getting. The purpose has been for drug abuse.
They only have certain drugs in there. They won't have other.
Right. They would only have the controlled substances in this database.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be a question for the Board of Pharmacy. Don't pharmacists already have some of that information in their database, so that if I go to my pharmacist with a prescription and they put that in, they know what they've already prescribed to me and how they interact. So that individual pharmacist essentially already has that report. This database is really about that, the communication between others if there's that shopping. But that report is being done on you and on me essentially every time we go to the pharmacist with a new prescription, and I'm glad for that because I wouldn't want inadvertently to be prescribed a drug that's going to kill me.
Chair Greenleg, Representative Gelser, sure. And if you go to the same pharmacy and you establish that relationship and you appreciate their checking on that and they visit with you and they give you a new drug and talk to you about interactions if you haven't done it with your doctor, fine. This is a database.
And if you go to the same doctor, right, you have that information in there.
Right. This is a database for the purposes of going after people who are abusing the system and obtaining drugs impermissibly. I think when we go to our doctor, we should not be presumed to be drug-seeking abusers, to which our doctor, without us even asking for that kind of drug to begin with, or our pharmacist, could run that on us. Again, we're talking about when you're not even prescribing this kind of drug. That conversation hasn't happened. So that's the rationale for that.
And my comment to that is I think the federal law already prohibits that sort of fishing expedition that you're talking about. So I think that maybe the language would be okay, but it would have to be consistent with federal and state law that currently exists.
Let's see, that was number 6. Number 7 in my list is on page 2 at the bottom there. This is to ensure that if, as a patient, I want to obtain my record and I request it, I don't wait 3 months to get it. I gave them 10 days, enough time, not the 24/7, but enough time and a turnaround time so that I can obtain my record. And so that a patient who wants to have it shouldn't have to keep asking for it.
Mr. Chair?
I'm wondering if this might have to be revised 10 days from the time that's actually in the database, because if there's matching issues, let's say somebody goes in and does a prescription and then decides the next day that they want their, it might not get in the system within that 10 days, so, I mean, there might be a lag. I'm just...
Chair Greenleg, Representative Kotick, then your database entries would be blank. I mean, the report would be nothing. It's only once it's in the data system that you're entitled to. This doesn't say this is not giving you some new authority to say the report, your entry must be entered within 2 days because I'm now calling you 3 days later and I want it. It is, what do you have on me at the time I'm making the request, and please provide that within 10 days. Okay. If you'd be kind enough to turn the page, you're on page what is marked 2A. The first piece is removing the provisions of sharing this with other states. There is no state doing this, I believe, currently except for a pilot project. The testimony on the other side was most likely it would be at least 3 to 4 years. And I may be mistaken that they're state student, but I have read about a pilot project, I think, between some northern state, northwestern states. The testimony that I noted down from the other side when this was discussed was that it will take at least 3 to 4 years for Oregon to be up and running to, in a place where they could share it. I would ask that they come back and seek the authority from you, that you can ensure that you're comfortable with them sharing it with other states at the time that it presents the availability to do so.
Mr. Chair, clarification from the board. Sharing with other states required under the grants?
It is not required under the grant we currently hold, I believe, and I need to clarify that for you. It will be required for additional grants. I do know that. So I will get clarification for you on that, on the grant that we are holding right now.
Is your expectation that we'll get additional grants simply because we can get the grants? Or because we'll get the grants because it serves some function that we believe is important on a policy basis?
Chair Greenlick, I do believe that we will get the grant based on the fact that we are providing this program for Oregon and that those giving the grants find this to be a very important thing to do.
I didn't frame my question correctly.
Okay.
We would apply for an additional grant because it meets some policy objectives that we have to get an additional grant, or because it's available?
Chair Greenlick, probably both. It is available. It will help us to enhance the program further. You heard IT saying that they would like to enhance various things, et cetera.
What enhancements are needed? What's lacking in
this? That's what will be determined by the commission and the board once we get everyone together to find out what might be able to be the particular bells and whistles in the long run that this particular program might be having.
And Mr. Chair, we would have to provide authority for them to apply for that grant, correct, through the Ways and Means
process?
Well,
we didn't apply for authority for them to apply for the existing grant, did we?
I would assume so.
Excuse me, Representative Greenlick, I'm quite certain that we did. I'm not in charge of that in our office, but indeed.
Legislative? Because it can't happen. The E-Board or Ways and Means has to approve the going forward with a grant request, is my understanding. So there is some policy oversight somewhere along the line, right?
Continually.
Right.
Okay. Speaking of continually, let me move you along if I can. The next listing is 37A all the way down. I'm going to cover parts of it because it's not all the same thing. It's what you've already, it requires that they maintain the records and the data so that we know the identification of someone requesting it and the date and time it was released. This is both to ensure doctors could know that that's not me requesting that. It ensures pharmacists to know that. It ensures the system is working. It allows accountability.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, if I may, identification, it would be by, I would assume, a username, so that a username is associated with a provider. I mean, there's no way you know who's steady fingering their username and password. You assume that it's the person that's supposed to be doing it.
Representative Greenlick, Representative Maurer, and you see, I didn't write that into the statute. Yeah, I would assume that a doctor has got permission and somehow is a unique identifier in the system, and it's a safeguard for doctors as well. 37D is the requirement that they segregate the records to all requests made to law enforcement purposes. And the next part of it is that it's public records except for the identity of the individual. Let me explain the rationale. We've seen a lot of states where this is used extensively for law enforcement purposes. We've been assured that this is really not the purpose here for this one. Let's keep track on the front end. I want to be clear. I do not want anyone to know the person. It is not intended to be the person. I would be looking for, on February 12th, DEA requested a record. On March 15th, Clackamas County Sheriff requested a record with a court order. Or, if it's now federal government, doesn't always have to be. It's a purpose, and then it's a public record available so that we as a community society, the state, will know that this is really not getting the hits on law enforcement purposes. And you look, Representative Richardson, like you want to ask me a question, so I'm stopping, but
I'm just trying to understand you.
It's keeping track separately of, this is available for doctors, for pharmacists, and for law enforcement. They have access by a court order simply with probable cause, although what I'm not clear about is whether the Board of Pharmacy, noting that someone's record looks suspect, could call law enforcement. I'm not sure there's any prohibition. But the purpose is when law enforcement takes advantage of this, let's at least keep track so we know. Is it 5 law enforcement hits a year or 500? It seems to me other states do it. I just thought it's important to write it into the law and make it clear it's segregated so we, on the front end, it's an expectation, not on the back end, that we didn't get that yet.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Does the board have a problem with that? I think that's a reasonable...
Representative Kotek and Chair Greenlich, I believe that there is a component in the federal grant that requires that we delineate all of that and keep track of that anyway.
And Chair Burdick, Representative Kotek, I would add that the second paragraph about a public record is so that we know someone can request that, and it's not just, well, we've got it, but we're not going to give it to you.
Mr. Chair, I think we need to arise as the best educated representative leaves the room.
Okay, moving along.
Chapter 5, we get giving.
Yeah, you're in post 5 category now, so... Yeah. All hands are up.
Yes. 37N through P. Mm-hmm. Let me explain the purpose of what I asked for to happen. The current law provided that the Board of Pharmacy, if there was a breach or violation, could discipline. But if the Board of Pharmacy itself breaches, I don't think it really should discipline itself. And that is why the Attorney General is brought into the bill as the protection if there's a breach, both released to individuals. So,
Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Ms. Meyer, how do you define?
Step team.
Thank you. How do you define what's an improper release of information?
Chair Greenlich, Representative Bonamici, I didn't write it, but a court will. I think what they were trying to do was encompass anything. So I think what they were trying to do by improper release was an outside hacker who comes in, because part of this is notification, and you didn't take the safeguards to protect against an outside hacker coming in. Someone from the inside doing action purposely or really recklessly, grossly negligently. That's a release. That's a disclosure, and the other's a breach. And so I think they did an improper release as to encompass all of that. Kinds of ways that...
No, we're still at four.
Okay.
We're at five. Can the rest of us hang in until 5:30? Is that feasible or not? 5:25? 5:30
is fine. Okay.
Okay. We'll adjourn at 5:30 and... Let me start right now. Where we need to go from here is a process that between now and Tuesday figures out which of these amendments are potentially fatal, which are not desirable, and which are desirable in their own right. And I'm not sure how we...
I'd be happy to...
How we do that process. Will you help on that one?
If I could meet with them, we can get this hammered out. I've already met with Board of Pharmacy, and they have no problem with most of these. And with some minor tweaks on a couple of them, it'd be fine.
I'd be happy to.
Good.
Okay.
Since we're talking about this, I agree that many of these concerns in the Dash 12 are valid, and that they need to be incorporated. But the ones that are crucial or vital to the continuation of the ability of the state to get in grants, I think that's where the yielding is going to have to
occur. Well, let's find out where. That's exactly what I was hoping. We have a process that looks at which.
And so I'm encouraging both sides to yield when it's appropriate to get this through, and I hope that occurs.
Chair Greenlich, Representative Maurer, yes. The one thing I would like to say on the record is I'd really love to see the actual documentations behind the requirements,
yep,
so that I'm confident when I represent to you that it was...
We want to be confident, too.
So just to clarify also, 37N through P is basically also requiring the board to notify when there's been an improper release. There's no duty to tell you. Now we get to 37Q through T. Many states, this is the civil action against the board, the board for damages resulting in proper release within $1,000 nominal and actual damages to be proven. Actually, if you look at the list of states that I gave you at the outset, most of them have civil liability, some as high as $250,000 based on the type of negligence or willfulness. So this portion was, look, if you release my information wrongfully, I'm entitled to $1,000. If there's more that actually damaged me, then I need to prove that.
Everyone, well, we can talk about that. I guess the question really is, why would the whole board be liable for the action of any board member? But that's something that can be worked out.
Oh, Chair Greenlee, Representative Richardson, it's not intended to be the board. It's this database and the people who are secured. If they let someone who's not authorized to do it, the board should be liable. And if someone who's authorized to use it does something impermissible, they should be liable. The board. They have a duty to protect this information.
Speak up.
Representative Greenlee.
I'll speak up here.
Representatives, I want to speak as little as possible, but this language is extremely critical because it is unprecedented for the state to allow itself, which that's what this would do. Under sovereign immunity, you would invite a strict liability civil cause of action against your Board of Pharmacy. And I would represent that that is extremely provocative and not to be done without thoroughly understanding the ramifications of that, along with the language immediately preceding it.
Chair Greenlee, I just note that North Carolina has the same
still have five. Okay.
Practice in its law, all related to this type of law. I think that takes you to turn the page to what is 2B.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would also have concerns with deleting lines 41 through 44. It's just something we need to talk about. I wouldn't want a chilling effect for people who are trying to use this database in good faith, worrying that the minute they touch it, they're going to have a lawsuit filed against them. Why would anybody want to use it then? I mean, I think that's...
Sure. Okay. Yeah. I think
turn the page.
Page
which maybe. Takes into that. Oh,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, this is... Chair, Representative Kotek, yes. The replacement language is a broader language, more protective of the individuals whose data is going to be now acquired to ensure that... unless there's gross negligence, criminal intent, I'm reading this, malice, criminal intent, gross negligence, I'd actually included negligence, they didn't do it, recklessness or willful intent, anyone operating this is immune. But the current standard was simply good faith, and I felt strongly good faith isn't sufficient. There's always going to be good faith unless we get into a criminal activity. And it seems that this kind of information needs to be maintained with the highest quality. And if it's not, then they're liable. You know, Providence Hospital. There was no action for the folks who were damaged by that. I remember talking to the Attorney General. There was no ability to seek recourse. There should be.
Terry, if the level is gross negligence, criminal intent, it's a fairly high threshold. Yeah, it really is.
Okay. Turn the page. If you'd be so kind, you're now on... I can't tell what page that is, but it's three. You'll see 6A. Oh, okay, mine got lost.
3.
Thank you. You start with 6A. This is the process of if you are wrongfully in the records. Now, we're told that there's just no way this is going to happen, but if John Smith has the same birth date, it might happen, or there's just human error. So I wanted to make sure that there was a clear process if record contains wrong information, and that's what 6A through I, I believe, requires. So 6A through E is an appeal process. Upon the receipt, the board shall conduct a contested case hearing. It requires due process protections if there's a dispute about the fact that that's not them. I can't imagine ever going to this level, but if you indeed say, that is not me on that, you need to, and they say, yes, it is, you need to have some process available to adjudicate that issue.
By the way, I discussed this with the board, and the board may not be able to specifically remove it because it's the pharmacy that puts it in, but it certainly would be appropriate for the board to ensure that it gets removed. Now, that's what we're really saying is that a patient who's got a problem
shouldn't have to be scurrying around trying to figure out what to do about it. They can contact the board, and the board will assure that it gets rectified if there's been an erroneous problem.
Correct. And Chair Richardson, I could imagine where a pharmacy enters it all correctly, but you have two John Smiths with the same birth date, and so they're going to merge in that record.
Madam Co-Chair, who's in charge here?
Mr. Vice Chair.
Okay. I didn't know is there a word missing from this first two sentences? Because I think it should say an individual who's had controlled substance prescription information entered erroneously. Or is that are we in a section that's talking only about erroneous information?
Chair, Representative Juanamichi, I think to remove erroneous information, I mean, if language can be tightened, that's fine, but it goes to remove the erroneous information. So I think, we may already be talking about erroneous information, but yes, the purpose is to remove erroneous information.
Fine, just a moment. Your name again, please.
Tom Cowan, Representative Richardson.
Cowan?
Cowan, C-O-W-A-N.
Got it.
And my understanding is that we may be working offline on some of these things, but this is another extremely significant provision, because the contested case will be being conducted with the board over an action that the board may or may not be able to correct or even direct to be corrected. It's one thing that's really important for you to understand is that these amendments reorient the Board of Pharmacy in relationship to this entire bill. And this is one of the examples. It puts the board in a situation that it was not in under the present language of direct, and you can see that in the verbiage that's being used, release, correct. Those verbs indicate a reorienting of the Board of Pharmacy. And that comes with cost, and it comes with liability. And that's what our concerns are.
Chair Richardson.
Well, cost and liability, but it's also responsibility. Yeah. I mean, the focus of these is to assure that a patient isn't left out. If there's a mistake placed into the database, who's going to fix it? It's not the patient's responsibility to fix it. And so, I'd be happy to have us discuss that, but if there's somebody that's got to be responsible to fix it, who's it going to be? If not the board, it's not the patient's responsibility if there's been an improper allocation of records or entry of records.
I would have two responses to that, Representative Richardson. Number one, if it's going to be the board, and remember the board is you, I mean, it's the government.
The board is the Board of Pharmacy.
Right, exactly.
That's right.
The steward.
Like separation of powers in this state. You may not have noticed that.
Point well taken. I apologize. The other thing is that the logical person or entity to make those corrections are the pharmacy, who, by the way, is under the direct regulatory relationship with the board. Can the board facilitate bringing the pressures to bear to correct an incorrect entry? Yes. Should the board be going to contest a case with all of the patients who may have a problem with Rite Aid? That, we believe, you need to understand the full ramifications of that.
That's a very good point. And there's a difference between lines A through D and the lines after that.
I'm now entirely confused about this bill. I'm looking at the first page of this bill in the original language, and it states the State Board of Pharmacy shall establish and maintain a database for electronically reporting the dispensing of controlled substances. So not only do they have the authority to establish it, they are the ones maintaining it.
Right. I mean, this is a change. There has to be somebody responsible for how this is happening, and the board is the one to do it. If you're bringing up a point saying, is it the intention that the board would appear at contested case hearings, well, we have to look at that.
And
absolutely.
Chair Green, look, I'd prefer that the board don't oversee its own hearing, so I'd be happy to have it through some other agency or oversight, because that raises a sufficient conflict of interest, which was the attempt by bringing the Attorney General into some of the process. If there's a breach, that the pharmacy board breaches this data, it's released, they have to tell the Attorney General and all of us. They can't just slap themselves on the hand.
Oh, as you know, there's a little conflict of interest in that firm, which also represents the Board of Pharmacy.
True, Chair Greenlick, but they do see consumer protections, and there's going to be a new law in place that will apply to states and government entities on release of information, and I think it will be the government that will be ensuring that as well.
Did you have a question?
Yes, the question is.
Right. 16J and 6J and 6K there, sub 13, is just making it clear that this database may not be used for commercial purposes. The advisory committee. This is one of the areas that I have asked to have some additional amendments, and what I wanted to what these amendments did was add two folks to the advisory committee, one with expertise in security for electronic database, and one with consumer privacy protection. The changes that I'm making are twofold. It will not be the authority of the Board of Pharmacy to appoint them, but the Senate and the House. And what I've had asked to be written is that the House will appoint a person with the expertise for security of electronic databases currently in it, and then one member from a group that advocates for privacy and medical records that I picked out of the Dash 11. The Senate will appoint one member with expertise in consumer privacy protections and a group that represents patient rights and interests, again, excerpted out of Dash 11. I raise the concern that it would be our hope that the amendments might include that the entities, be it the Board of Medical Examiners and medical other folks, get to appoint or bring forward their names, and that the Board of Pharmacy can't pick and choose the persons from those other entities. They certainly can choose it for their board, but the advisory committee should come from truly all those folks and not handpicked by anyone other than those who oversee those folks. The other amendments that I think were removed that I wanted to reference was I'd actually had criminal sanctions in here, and it wasn't intended to be. But interestingly enough, again, most of the states I reviewed had criminal sanctions, up to felonies for different kinds. So, you know, I leave it to your discretion, and there may be criminal already covered, but I had in my dash whatever new amendments, it was my intention to remove that. Also, what was not included but was supposed to be...
Would you reference a specific line that you're talking about?
Well, I'm not sure. Did it get put in these? Because I must have missed it.
Bottom of page 4.
Thank you. I'm so sorry.
26A through...
Oh, there it is. Yes. Thank you. 18 and 19. I may have skipped ahead on my cross-reference. I didn't turn the page. That's the problem. 18.
We're fine.
Okay. Section 9... clarifies the disciplinary action. I think that's consistent with the language that was already in the bill in terms of oversight. If it's erroneously disclosed, that the appropriate health professional regulatory board can take disciplinary action. On page 4, starting on H, that's the criminal portion, and that goes down over to, I believe, potentially the next page. But I think...
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
And I'm just kind of curious, Andrea, in other states that have these, have they had to utilize them? I'm just curious.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, I have absolutely no idea. It was just my review, and I gave it to you. You can see on that list of sheets that many had them. I have no idea.
I'm just wondering, yeah, if it does.
Yeah. It's been hard enough for me to... I've worked scrambling to get this information. I've not been in touch with any state. I'm almost done. Let me please take a moment. Halfway through on that page 4A, civil penalties imposed, Department of Justice adopting rules, remedies. That's so that there's oversight by Department of Justice. That's what I talked about earlier, ensuring that if there's the Board of Pharmacy, which is responsible for establishing and maintaining the database, breaches that there's oversight. Section 10 is really important. Section 10 is FF through JJ. I want to ensure that if the database is either not 24/7, is either not real-time, or is not working at the moment, and you get to your pharmacy and they say, we can't run your name right now, and we're not going to give you the prescription, and maybe that won't happen, but if it were a pharmacist who wanted to make that happen, they cannot. If your doctor has prescribed you that drug and you show up at the pharmacy that day to get it filled and they cannot verify it, they err on the side of giving you the drugs you need that day. These are pain meds. If the doctor has, and maybe the doctor's already run you and assured it, but the board, the pharmacy itself cannot override the doctor's decision in the case where the database is not operational at that time.
Are you done?
Sorry.
No, are you done? Are you through?
No, there was one amendment that didn't get included. And that was the requirement that they purge your information every 2 years. There was testimony on the other side. I've heard some comments now that they're going to require it for 3 years. But I did hear testimony on the other side that some states have it for 3 and some states have it for 2. So, again, I'd like to have an understanding of why other states have enacted these, and according to the testimony on this side, they were able to do it in 2 years. That's supposed to be included in the amendments.
All right. Where we're going is that Representative Richardson, if he needs more muscle, as I said before, House of Representative Bonamici, will meet with whoever are the political parties and see which of these we can get in, which improve it, and which destroy it, and try and separate. So I hope we can come to some clear understanding about that. And we'll... Sandy?
Sir?
Is this back up from Tuesday?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, if it's possible, we'll do it some more on Tuesday. Could we automatically put it on Thursday just to make sure?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we can.
And we'll put both... we're putting the other one that we're carrying over for Thursday as well. Is that right?
Correct.
Yes, we'll probably need a couple days on that.
I'm sure we will. So we'll schedule everything that's undone at this moment for both Tuesday and Thursday.
Everything?
So we'll make sure we don't
it's
have anything left off. How many do we have left? Where are we? I think we're down to 4.
Oh, I have...
I need your card.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to thank everyone involved. I don't know if I have a complete sense of where folks on the committee feel, but I think there's some understanding that this is, at least in my opinion, we need to do something. But I think the suggestions we've gotten from Andrea are very helpful. And so the fullest extent possible that we can do these and still maintain the funding... And I, again, looking at the regs that are coming down on that issue, I think we have a much better product because of this discussion. So,
Chair Greenlee,
we can reach them.
We can.
Representative Kotek, I think if you're going to build this in Oregon, and the ACLU will always oppose it, you better build the Cadillac. You better build the one that doctors can really use live. Again, most of the ones that currently exist, many of them don't have that. And you need to build the one that is the most secure and safe. Look at Kentucky's $1.4 million. If you go forward with it, let me just assure you, my amendments do not provide the adequate protections. They provide some due process, some minimal safeguards, some sideboards that you asked. I could not ensure a sufficient database structure and safety.
Close the hearing on Senate Bill 34. Let me just replay the bidding. We'll do 34 and 145 on Thursday. And anything left over for Tuesday. We have 163, which I understand we're pretty much have agreement on. We have 337, which I think we're going to probably have agreement on. We have 656, which we may or may not have agreement on, but we'll try and do on Tuesday. If not, we'll hold over until Thursday. We have 717, which I... I'm not crazy about the notion that the Board of Medical Examiners will do that. I would like to find out whether the Oregon Health Policy Commission can take that job on scope of practice.
That's the scope of practice review.
Yeah, the scope of practice.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Oh, we're not. Never mind. We can't discuss.
No, it's all right. We're an open meeting.
I believe that bill is very important. Even if we shorted the sunset on it, it needs to survive this process.
I believe it's important too, but I don't believe the Board of Medical Examiners is necessarily the right home for it.
And I'm not going to disagree.
That's the only
but
issue.
If that was the only home, that even shortening the sunset on this would be a better alternative than just to kill it.
I'm hoping we can give it to the Oregon Health Policy Commission and they won't scream. The problem is, if we do, it might end up with a fiscal we don't want to hear, and we'll see what we can do with that one.
Good luck.
Tuesday. And then we have a new one coming up, Senate Bill 614, which it says here requires members of boards of hospital authorities to file a statement of economic interest and declare a potential conflict of interest with whatever. And we'll see that for the first time on Tuesday, and probably we'll finish it. Yeah, we can't hear it before 3:20 on Tuesday, so we'll hear it after 3:20 and probably finish that up.
Mr. Chair, are we allowed to stay late on Tuesday and Thursday?
We are.
Should we assume that we're staying till 6 then?
Okay. Let's assume.
I'm just, the problem is that other committees are doing the same
thing. Are they going from 5 to 6?
I want it starting at 6.
Pardon me? No, we're talking about going till 6.
Right,
going till 6.
You don't need to eat.
No.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure we need to stay till 6. Well,
we'll be expeditious.
Let's think about 5:30 both days. That should be enough. But Thursday, it'll be our last day, so we'll need to stay as long as we need to stay to get done what we're doing. Okay?
34 is off now, Tuesday. We're just scheduling for Thursday.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to get things done in time between now and Tuesday, but it puts all the eggs in one basket at that point.
Then. It won't be a problem.
Yeah. Okay. Anybody have any other business? We're adjourned.